My name is John Sylvester. I'm Australia's longest-serving crime reporter and write a weekly column for The Age. Many of my colleagues have wondered why I've never bothered to move to other areas of the paper. The reason's pretty simple. I've got the best job in journalism, playing cops and robbers and getting paid for it. Over more than 40 years, I've covered some of Australia's biggest crimes and met fascinating characters on both sides of the law. In this series, you'll hear from them, the cops and the crooks, telling their stories. Welcome to my world. Welcome to Naked City.
For a story that's gripped Melbourne, today provided another riveting chapter. Underworld figure Dominic Gatto acquitted of murder.
Thank God for the jury system. That's all I can say.
Of all the people caught up in Melbourne's underworld war, I always found Mick Gatto the most fascinating. Unlike Carl Williams and Tony Mockbell, Gatto tried to keep a low profile. That is, until he shot dead Melbourne hitman Andrew Veneman inside a Carlton restaurant in March 2004. When they were researching the Channel 9 TV series Underbelly, Mick said he wanted nothing to do with it. But in the end, I took the producers out to see him at his crane depot. Business must have been really good because there wasn't one crane there. This is how the show portrayed his fatal meeting with Andrew Benji Veneman.
Fuck you!
Giovanni, it's been some trouble. I just shot Andrew Veneman. He's dead. Call the police. Call the police.
Mick had become a household name after the hit 9 Underbelly series, but he was still keen to keep a low profile. But in 2009, he agreed to have a chat with me. I asked him to take me through what actually happened with Andrew Veneman. He came to see you?
He certainly did, yeah. I actually rang him because he was wanting to see me, and the week before he spoke to me and he said, I've got to come and see you. I hadn't seen him for a couple of months and he was running with the other side there, and I was just curious what he wanted. So I rang him on this day and he rocked up there, and he was the one that actually suggested we go out the back and have a quiet chat, and that's when it all took place, you know.
And what happened? He pulled a gun on you?
Well, it started off, you know, that I was telling him that the rumours were still ripe that he had something to do with Graham, and he said, mate, I wouldn't do that to you, you're a friend of mine. And I said, well, it's funny you say that, PK and Dibra were your friends too, and you killed them. And anyway, we got in a little bit of a heated argument, and I just said to him, look, you can't be trusted, and I don't want you in my company, in our company, simple as that. And the next minute he just stepped back and produced the gun. And then we had a struggle, and one nearly hit me in the head. And fortunately, he got shot. I never. He died, and that was the end of it. The rest is history.
He was arrested at the scene and spent 14 months in solitary confinement before his trial. He was acquitted on the grounds of self-defence and could have demanded big money for an interview. Instead, he agreed to chat to me for nothing. He said he thought I'd always been fair to him. That's how it works in those circles. Respect those you think are fair and punish those you think are not. Inside his house, he paused, looked at me and said, you know, I'm doing this as a personal favour to you. Afterwards, we sat outside with his mates. Mick, in a sweat top, gold bling, cigar, short black coffee. It was like a scene out of The Sopranos. At one point, the pool filter let out a big bubble that burst to the surface. One of the ghetto gang, deadpan, said, hey Mick, I don't think he was dead when you put him in there. Back in the early 2000s, Melbourne was gripped by this underworld war. The Moran family and Carl Williams, who'd once been partners, were deep into a deadly power struggle. It seemed like gangsters were being shot on a weekly basis. Gatto, above all else, was a businessman, and he saw the underworld war as just a stupid waste of time. He stayed right out of it and didn't take sides. He knew Carl Williams had gone to war with the Morans after the Morans shot Williams in a park on Carl's 29th birthday. Gatto was just an interested observer, that is, until his great friend and father figure, Graham, the Munster Kinnebra, was gunned down in Kew.
62-year-old career criminal Graham Allan Kinnebra arrived at his home in Belmont Avenue, Kew, just after midnight when he was shot several times.
Graham was like a second father to Mick, and now it was personal. Gatto loved the veteran safecracker. So when Kinnebra was shot, Mick was on the move.
It's clear the man has been ambushed and executed.
He blamed underworld boss Carl Williams for the murder of Graham Kinnebra. He was right. Williams recruited two other gunmen to kill Kinnebra outside his Kew home. And as usual, he failed to pay them what he promised. Mick told me how important Kinnebra had been to him and what kind of person he was.
And Graham, you know, was a man I loved, and it really hurt me when Graham went. And I'll say that publicly, it did. Love the bloke. There was no need for that. I mean, the bloke was an innocent man. He was a good man, and, you know, he was respected on both sides of the fence. He could talk to anyone, and people used to come to him for advice, you know, and he'd never repeat to anyone he'd sort of spoken to or whatever.
The Melbourne underworld was mostly run by a loose group of associates. Mick, Graham Kinnebra, the Morans, that's Lewis, sons Mark and Jason, Mario Condello, and years earlier, Alphonse Gangitano. They were dubbed the Carlton Crew by the media, a name Gatto says was fabricated. What is true is that of all that crew, Mick is the only survivor.
Funny thing, the Carlton Crew's only come to light after a few of these killings happened. There was never ever any Carlton Crew. In fact, Lewis Moran and all that gang there, they're all friends of mine, yeah, but I see them once a month. Once every 6 weeks, I hardly ever see them. There was never any meetings in the Carlton Football Stadium like there was on Underbelly. And, you know, I mean, we're all friends, but there was no Carlton Crew. I used to run around 90% of my life with a pensioner, an 80-year-old man who's since died, God bless him. And that was my days. I was with him every day of the week. And, you know, we used to have meetings of all sorts of people and in restaurants and all that. But there was no Carlton Crew. That's just all been a myth. It's, you know, it's not true, and it's just been invented just to sort of sell papers and make good television, I guess.
Gatto was keen to distance himself from the Moran family. He told me he didn't do business with them.
So there was no business connections between you and the Morans?
There was no business connection, no. We were friends. I was more friendly with the father than the sons. You know, I like Lewis. He was a good bloke, a good, honest bloke. And, you know, like I said, I'd see him once a month, once every 6 weeks, and, you know, I respected him and vice versa.
A number of your friends have been killed over the years. Just a few words on a couple of them. Alphonse Gangitano, what was he like?
Alphonse Gangitano was dubbed the Black Prince of Lygon Street. He was charismatic and deadly. Al loved the gangster image, and we fell out after I said a few words on radio that offended him for some reason. So much so he sued me. Probably because I said Alphonse John Gangitano has the brains of a flea and the genitalia to match. It certainly would have been an interesting court case, but he was shot dead before we could do battle. He was actually shot dead in his own home by his one-time great mate, Jason Moran.
Well, Alphonse was a good bloke. You know, unfortunately, you know, towards the end, he sort of went a bit scatty or whatever, but, you know, he was a good bloke, but he liked the Lygon Street scene and all that sort of thing. Yeah, but we were friends, and, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate what happened, but that's life, you know. I mean, a lot of people have been gone and a lot of people have been killed, and, you know.
Lewis Moran, what was he like?
Lewis Moran was the father of Jason and the stepfather of Mark. He was the patriarch of the legendary Moran crime family.
Lewis was a good bloke. Like I said before, Lewis, you know, was a bloke that sort of, you know, he looked after his family and he'd done his own little thing. And, you know, he was pretty quiet and didn't rock the boat too much. And, I mean, to kill him, you know, it was just like, running into a nursing home and killing an invalid, you know what I mean? It's exactly the same thing. I mean, it was a low act. I mean, the man couldn't move, couldn't even pull the trigger. You know, if you're going to kill anyone, kill someone that can defend themselves or whatever, you know? But, yeah, he was a good man. He was a good man. It's a shame that he went the way he went.
You weren't close to him, but Jason, what was he like?
Jason, I never had a lot to do with Jason until probably, you know, 6 months, the last 6 months of his life, and he was always, you know, pretty ratty, and the last 6 months of his life, I got to know him a little bit, and I got to like him, and I've seen the side of him I've never seen before, his family, and he was caring and worried about him, whatever, and yeah, and I felt sorry for him. You know, I think everyone in town knew he was going to go, including himself.
Jason Moran knew Williams would try to kill him, and he started using counter-surveillance. But he always went to the Essendon North Auskick. In that business, routine can be deadly.
You know, so I can never understand why the police didn't put full surveillance on all these people that were targets. They knew who the targets were, but anyway, we won't get into that.
Mark Moran?
Mark, I didn't have a lot to do with, but he was a gentleman and a fitness fanatic. And again, bloke that minded his own business, very quiet, never rocked the boat, wasn't aggressive, and a gentleman as far as I was concerned. And, you know, again, it's sad. You know, he's got children and family and that he's left behind that are probably still grieving. And, you know, all this nonsense is terrible. It's just blown out of proportion and you know, it's just all formed through paranoia, you know. And I think a lot of these people got killed through paranoia.
It was obvious that police needed to stop the war, and that meant stopping Carl Williams. Mick understood that Jason and Mark Moran started the war and Williams was entitled to fight back. But in the end, Carl just went too far. If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Unless, of course, you don't like it, then shut up.
This is Carl Williams at his arrogant best, eyes cool, calm under pressure, and with absolutely nothing to say to Victoria Police.
Is it your intention to remain mute for the remainder of the interview in relation to any questions asked about this offence?
The judge detailed the horrific crimes he'd pleaded guilty to, the execution-style murders of Jason Moran, Lewis Moran and Mark Marlier. He'd been convicted by a jury of a fourth murder, that of Michael Marshall. For the first time, Nine News...
Eventually, Williams had to plead guilty to a series of murders, including Lewis and Jason Moran. Mick's reflections on Williams seem not to be tinged with real hatred.
Carl Williams?
What about him?
What do you think of him?
Well... Carl got shot and he was entitled to retaliate whatever way he wanted to retaliate. And I mean, you know, if I was shot by someone, I'd be trying to even up and do whatever you got to do to even up to. But I think he pushed it a bit too far. And I think he might have been using his own product a bit. And people were getting in his ear and the paranoia was setting in. And people looking for business, you know, saying kill this one, kill that one. And of course, there's all sorts of money being thrown up. And I think that's why a lot of these people got killed that shouldn't be dead today, you know? And unfortunately, you know, I mean, I don't blame Carl. I do, I blame him. I mean, he's killed him. I blame him. Of course I blame him. But I think, like I said, it was the paranoia and the drugs and the people around him. And I've got to be honest, I feel sorry for him, but he's over 21.
You had a meeting with Carl Williams trying to sort it out at one stage at the casino?
Well, I wasn't trying to sort it out. I was trying to find out who killed Graham. And, until that point, you know, it had nothing to do with me. You know, it was a war over him getting shot by Jason and whatever happened there was their business. Nothing to do with me. But once they killed Graham, yeah, you know, it involved me then. And he was a very dear friend of mine. And, yeah, I was making active moves to find out who was behind it. And that was the reason for the meeting with Carl, and he, you know, denied it strenuously. He said he respected Graham, he never knew him, he had nothing to do with it. I don't know about that. I think he did. Maybe it'll come out one day, but that's the only time I got dragged into this mess.
Did it enter your mind that perhaps you could be a target along the way?
Well, you know, it's got to enter your mind, I guess, because people tie you together and they tie you into it all, and the next minute paranoia sets in with all these people, and of course you're a target, and of course people are getting killed for nothing, you know, like Graham Kinnamborough and people like that, that, you know, it's just a waste of life, you know. And yeah, answering your question, yeah, I would have been a target. I would have been.
Today, Carl Williams was still the smiling assassin as he sat in the Supreme Court dock and learned of his fate, life in prison with a 35-year minimum. He'd loosened his tongue and admitted to the offences to get...
Williams was doing hard time in prison, just as Mick had done. I asked him about that daily routine. It eventually wore Williams down, which is why he chose to become a police informer.
Having been through it yourself, what would Carl Williams' daily routine be?
Mate, they get treated like animals in there, I mean. You know, he'd be up at 7:30 in the morning, breakfast. He'd come out of his cell, I don't know whether he's out for an hour or longer than that, but if he's out for an hour, well, in that hour he's got to clean his cell, make the phone calls, cook, wash his clothes, whatever, in that hour, and then he's locked up for the other 23 hours. But if he's out of his cell for longer than that, I'm not really sure how long he's out for. I think he is an acacia, so I'd imagine it's an hour or two. It's Hannibal Lecter stuff, mate. I mean, it's a jail inside a jail. The moment he goes out of that jail anywhere, he's shackled and handcuffed and everything's locked down, and, you know, you can't mingle with anyone or see anyone else. You know, the whole jail's locked down to let you go through, you know? And the same if you go on the court or whatever, you know? I mean, you're shackled and locked up in this little tiny cell inside a van. And, you know, I mean, you know... If they're going to jail people, you know, they should jail them, you know, the right way. I mean, you know, this is going back in the ice, well, the old days, you know. You know, I mean, they're going backwards, you know, I mean, rehabilitation and things like, you know, you can't lock people up like dogs and treat them the way that they've been treated, as far as I'm concerned. They're really trying to make it hard for them to make them roll over. And I mean, it's just, it's terrible what they're doing to people. But unfortunately, you know, there's two laws in this country. It's one for us and one for them, and that's the way it is.
Barwon Prison goes into lockdown as a steady stream of homicide detectives arrive to investigate the death of notorious underworld kingpin Carl Williams. The 39-year-old convicted murderer died after becoming involved in an altercation with two inmates inside the secure prison unit. Police say he was in an exercise section of the day yard when he was severely beaten about the head with a weapon. He suffered significant injuries and went into cardiac arrest.
In 2010, Williams was ambushed and murdered by fellow inmate Matthew Johnson. But prison didn't break Gatto. Mick Gatto was remanded in custody for the murder of Andrew Veneman. Much of that time, he was kept in solitary confinement. While most inmates go half mad in solitary, Gatto emerged 30 kilos lighter and back to the weight he was when he was a handy heavyweight. He spent his days shadowboxing and reading his brief of evidence.
Now, you were charged with murder. It was 14 months you spent?
14 months I spent in, like Hannibal Lecter, locked up and shackled like a dog. But anyway.
But that's broken a lot of people. How did you survive it?
I think just through training, you know. I used to spend the day training really hard in the cell and, you know, and doing as much as I could to sort of keep my mind active. I used to read the briefs that I had, you know, day in, day out. I nearly knew a chapter and verse. You know, that kept me sane. I'd done it more for my family and everyone out here. You know, I mean, would have done no good if I fell by the wayside. You know, would have done no one out here any good. So that was a reason, but mainly the training side of things, you know. I took on a really strenuous training regime just to sort of keep my mind active, you know.
That was shadow boxing?
A lot of shadow boxing in the cell. I used to shadow box in there for hours, and they used to walk past, you know, call me, what was that bloke's name, that movie? Denzel Washington was in, I can't remember it now.
Hurricane Carter.
Hurricane Carter, yeah, they'd yell at, you know, Hurricane Carter and all that, and, And no, I enjoyed it. You know, that was the only good thing that came out of jail, I guess. I lost a bit of weight and got fit.
Tough way to diet.
It's a tough way to diet, but, you know, I mean, I think anyone that does jail under the conditions that I was in, locked up 23 hours a day like a dog, you've got to do something like, you know, I mean, you know, picture yourself locked up in a bathroom for 23 hours a day, you know, with a TV and a shower. You know, of course you're going to go off your head. You've got to do something, you know.
So what was the trial like? I mean, it seems a pretty intimidating place, the Supreme Court.
Well, it was. This is my first time ever being in the Supreme Court and given evidence and being, you know, involved in a trial like that. And, it's, you know, I've got to be honest, I was pretty confident right through that I'd be acquitted until the last couple of days when Justice Cummins summed up, and he summed up even better than the prosecutor. He added stuff that the prosecutor never even mentioned. And I sort of, I've got to be honest, you know, when I left here, I thought, gee, you know, the whole world's against me here. And the day I walked back into the courtroom when the jury came out, and I'll never forget it. I mean, there was all the media there and the Piranha police, and it was like, you know, the Christian being thrown to the lion, you know. I just looked at them all and everyone was looking for blood. And I thought I had a problem, I've got to be honest, and only because of, you know, like I said, the way that the judge summed up in the end. But the jury seen through it all, and there was reasonable doubt there in a lot of areas, and I was never ever going to be convicted. Yeah, so.
Well, I was there and I saw you with your family just
you
in those
there.
Moments.
Yeah. You were there.
It's pretty interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I remember what you actually said, John, because I spoke to my family and I said, these are the most important one or two words we're ever going to hear in our lives. And I remember you adding, saying it'll be two words, and I said, I hope you're right. And unfortunately it was, so, you know. But it's a pretty harrowing experience, I guess.
How has it changed you?
How's it changed me? Oh, I don't think it's changed me. I'm sort of... Oh, I don't really think it has, you know. I'm sort of a little bit cautious, but, I mean, I still go along and do my own thing and mind my own business and keep my head held high, you know. And I don't think I've changed a lot. You'd probably have to ask people around me whether it has, but I don't seem to think it has.
Another character in Mick's story is Bernie Barmer, a lawyer who represented many of the underworld characters. I chatted to Bernie and asked him about Mick. Here's what he told me.
Look, I met Mick through the fight game when I was boxing myself. So I've known him for 25 years, always had a good relationship with him. Yes, I have represented him a few times, but I find him a charming sort of a fellow. Others that have a differing opinion, but that's their opinion. But, I mean, he's fine to me and always respectful to me and my family, so I get on well with him.
You ever hopped in the ring with him?
Yeah.
Who won?
I'd like to say I did. He's a strong man, very strong man.
Mick had a different version of his bout with Bernie, the attorney. The lawyer, Bernie Barmer, we interviewed him. He said he used to have a spar with you and declared he beat you. What's your recollection?
Well, Bernie was a very good six-round fighter when I first started fighting, and I actually just walked into the gymnasium. I was only there a week, and they threw me in to have a spar with him. He was fighting that weekend, if I recall correctly, a six-rounder, and we had a bit of a move around, and I won't go into it. He didn't win, but anyway. I don't want to throw petrol on a fire. He's my mate. I love him.
Mick Gatto likes to live the quiet life, but celebrity has found him. Something he says leaves him a little uncomfortable.
With the Underbelly TV series, it's made you sort of almost a bit of a celebrity. How does that...
it becomes a little bit uncomfortable. People drive you mad. You know, they chase you up the street for autographs and photos and all that. And, you know, I don't like to knock too many back. You know, I'm trying to be a gentleman about it. But it does become embarrassing at times, you know, when you go to a function or fights or whatever and there's people everywhere and, you know, people are running up, you know, crowding around you for autographs and photos, and it becomes like, you know, people looking on in the crowd and they're saying, oh, this bloke loves himself or whatever. But, I mean, I don't really enjoy it, but I do it just to try and do the right thing, you know.
Some police say Gatto got away with murder, but the jury accepted his plea of self-defence and that's all that matters. Since then, he's been hit with a massive tax bill, wound down his crane company, promoted boxing matches, sold his house and built another.
He bought a Rolls-Royce and has been accused of many things, but has not been charged. When the Piranha Task Force came to search his place, he chatted freely with the officers and even made them coffee, saying he knew they had a job to do. Well, they did that job pretty well, because they found 80 grand and a shotgun hidden in the wall. At a ghetto charity bash, men and women line up to kiss his cheek. I asked him once about this public recognition, and he said he was often stopped for a selfie or an autograph. And you know what, he said? I always do it, because you never know who's going to be on a jury. Naked City is brought to you by The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Subscriptions power our newsroom, so to support independent journalism, consider subscribing to the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode is produced and edited by Margaret Machine Gun Gordon and Anu the Axe Hasbolt, and mixed and mastered by Jellic Knight John Greenfield, with technical assistance from Cool Hand Cormac Lally. Tom McKendrick is head of audio. Archival is thanks to Nine and 3AW. Special thanks to Ace TV documentary filmmaker Terry Carline for the audio of Mick Gatto. I'm John Sylvester. Thanks for listening. Next episode is the cold-blooded killing of Phyllis Hocking. Stay tuned next Wednesday.
Why doesn't it shock you to hear that you might be the suspect of your mother's murder?
Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Our family stands to gain financially.
Did you kill your mother?
No, of course I didn't.